Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast was co-hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group and its Litigation Practice Group. It was recorded on April 4th, 2013, during a live teleform conference call. Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group teleform conference call. Today, we'll be discussing the life, legacy, and work of Judge Robert H. Bork, including his final book, Saving Justice, Watergate, the Saturday Night Massacre, and Other Adventures of a Solicitor General. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording today's call for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're very happy to welcome with us two experts. Both have long and distinguished careers that are described in some detail on our website, so I'll be brief in introducing them today. Stephen Calabrese is a professor of law at Northwestern University Law School. He's also co-founder and chairman of the board of the Federalist Society. Frank Easterbrook is the chief judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. He joined the court in 1985 after being nominated by President Ronald Reagan. As I say, their longer bios are available on our website, so let's get right to our discussion. Judge Easterbrook, please go ahead with your opening remarks.
Thank you. I worked as one of Robert Bork's assistants for 2.5 years, and we were friends between 1974 and his death last fall. But I need to open with a confession. I can't say very much about his final book, Saving Justice. I'll talk instead about Bob Bork, the man and the Solicitor General. The reason I can't say much about the book is that its principal focus is Bob's first 6 months on the job. When he wrote the brief that persuaded Spiro Agnew to plead guilty and resign as vice president, when he persuaded the Supreme Court to end Justice Douglas's crusade to stop the Vietnam War, when he fired Archibald Cox as Watergate special prosecutor and appointed Leon Jaworski to replace him, and when he served as acting attorney general for 3 months. The title, Saving Justice, comes from Bob's decision not to resign after the Saturday Night Massacre, which, by the way, he thinks should have been called the Saturday Night Involuntary Manslaughter, because Nixon just blundered into it. Bob believed that the president has the authority to control everyone in the executive branch. Whether a president is wise to exercise this authority is for history to decide. Bob also thought that he should not gain by carrying out presidential directions. So he planned to fire Cox, then quit. Elliot Richardson and William Ruckelshaus talked him out of resignation. There was no line of succession after the Solicitor General. So if Bob had walked away, the Department of Justice would have been leaderless. No telling who the president might install. Richardson, Ruckelshaus, and Bork all feared that it would be a political shill, leading the assistant attorneys general and much of the senior staff to resign en masse and crippling the department. So Bob Bork saved justice by staying. Had he quit in protest, he probably would have been treated as a hero and confirmed to the Supreme Court in 1987. Perhaps he would have been appointed by President Ford in 1976 to the seat that went to John Paul Stevens. But had he quit, the nation as a whole would have suffered. So he stayed. I can't say much more about those times. They occupied the last 6 months of 1973, and I did not arrive in the Solicitor General's office until mid-1974. But everything Bob Bork says in his book is entirely consistent with the man I knew for 40 years, intellectual, considering consequences before acting, devoted to the public welfare, even if he had to pay a cost, and absolutely honest. He's also the funniest man I ever met. That didn't come through in his 1987 hearings, but the book is full of his wit. The life of a Solicitor General, like the life of a judge, is reactive. Other people decide what suits to bring. The Solicitor General controls the government's presentations to the Supreme Court, petitions, responses, merits briefs, oral argument, and also decides when the government will appeal an adverse decision by a district court or seek rehearing en banc in a court of appeals. The SG also has authority to decide when, if at all, to participate as amicus curiae in either the Supreme Court or a court of appeals. It's a broad portfolio and requires a large base of knowledge, plus the ability to learn fast. The Solicitor General doesn't control who litigates about what, he also doesn't start the process within the government. Agencies make recommendations to the Justice Department. Cases are farmed out to the litigating divisions. They make recommendations, which go to the SG's assistants and deputies. Sometimes there's an internal conflict. The Bureau of Prisons wants to advance jailers' ability to control the population, while the Civil Rights Division wants to support prisoners. Or an assistant to the Solicitor General may think that the Criminal Division's statutory theory, in some cases, is weak. The SG has to resolve these issues personally. Bob Bork conducted many conferences, not only to settle fights within the government, but also to hear presentations by private counsel. It's one of the office's traditions that anyone, a litigant, a potential amicus curiae, can be heard by the SG personally before the United States files a brief in the Supreme Court. Bob prepared carefully and asked sharp questions. As he said in his book, he tried to advance the position of the executive branch, not his own views. I never saw him favor his own position and never saw him misunderstand an argument. He displayed knowledge, understanding, and intellectual integrity. I'll tell you the story behind one of these cases, but first I want to mention the last of the SG's tasks, oral argument. Bob Bork was the best oral advocate of his generation, as any of the justices would tell you. And he argued a lot, twice every session, or 14 times a term. His successors have tended to argue between 5 and 10 cases a year. Not Bob. He loved the give and take and was fast on his feet. Often the main task of an advocate for the United States is to find a new argument to replace the bad one that lost the case in the Court of Appeals. Sometimes the task of an oral advocate is to patch up holes in an argument already presented in the brief. Trying to do either is chancy. The justices are apt to point out the forfeiture and tell the advocate to move along. It takes gravitas to get them to listen. The first time I saw Bob in action, he had to paper over a very bad argument. Congress had taken over the bankrupt Eastern Railroads, merging them to form Conrail and Amtrak. The railroads sued, contending that the law was an unconstitutional taking and should be enjoined. The lead argument in the brief filed by the United States, a brief that Bob had not vetted carefully because there was no conflict within the government, was that Congress and the Interstate Commerce Commission had fiddled so often in the operation of railroads that it was just impossible for a taking to occur. The railroads had no rights they could rely on. The problem with this argument is that if it were to prevail, Congress could abolish the takings clause by passing a statute claiming a right to do anything to private property anytime for any reason without compensation. The justices were not about to buy that. Well, Justice Douglas maybe, but nobody else. Solicitor General Bork took the argument himself and scuttled the main position in the brief. He withdrew it and advanced a different position, that the Tucker Act would provide any compensation due, so the statutes could not be enjoined. After all the takings clause does is provide money after the fact. That argument went well. The sponsor of the legislation in the House, Brock Adams, had been given time to argue as amicus curiae. He was there to defend the government's original argument that Congress had for so long behaved whimsically in the railroad business that it acquired an easement across the takings clause. But once he got to his feet, all the justices cared about was Bob Bork's argument about the Tucker Act. Representative Adams eventually tried to get away from that theme by telling the justices that the House and Senate had not thought one moment about compensation, so they should just forget the Tucker Act. Well, what a blunder. The Tucker Act applies unless repealed. Adams had just told the court that the Tucker Act had not been repealed, indeed hadn't even been considered. It didn't take the court long to issue a unanimous opinion, deciding the case Bob Bork's way for Bob Bork's reasons. I have time for only one other vignette, and have chosen Buckley against Valeo, the challenge to the Federal Election Campaign Act brought to the Supreme Court by Senator James Buckley with the assistance of Professor Ralph Winter, Bob's friend and colleague from Yale Law School. The statute set contribution and expenditure limits for campaigns for federal office, and it also made the Federal Election Commission independent of the president. so as to take politics out of politics, some said, but more plausibly to shift the balance of political control toward Congress and incumbents, who would have a greater share of the say. Solicitor General Bork assembled his SWAT team for politically sensitive cases, Deputy Solicitor General Raymond Randolph and me. We went to work on a brief that must stand as one of history's curiosities. This brief, filed for the Attorney General as appellee and for the United States as amicus curiae, goes to great lengths to explain why speech and money are interchangeable, why it surely would violate the First Amendment to set a limit on how much the New York Times could charge for the paper or pay its reporters, and therefore, well, you can draw the therefore. Next time somebody tells you that a contribution or expenditure limit for elections is just about money, and that money is not speech, you should reply that New York Times against Sullivan was just a case about money for tort damages, that NAACP against Claiborne Hardware was just a case about money to pay for economic injury to businesses, and that the Alien and Sedition Acts were just laws about imprisonment. And you should note, by the way, that the New York Times is a corporation, and therefore, according to its own editorial policy, has no rights under the First Amendment. Many churches also have corporate form. But the briefs left it to the justices to draw their own conclusions. Well, that's always a risky step. Why this failure to go to the limit when Bob Bork had such strong views? Well, a list of signatures on the brief tells the story. This brief was signed by Attorney General Levy, Solicitor General Bork, Deputy Solicitor General Randolph, and a guy without a title, me. On the same day, Attorney General Levy, Solicitor General Bork, Deputy Solicitor General Friedman, and another guy without a title, filed a brief on behalf of the Federal Election Commission and the United States as a party, defending the statute's constitutionality. Yep, Bob Bork and the Department of Justice managed to be on opposite sides of the same case at the same time. So if you think that Buckley is an odd opinion, sustaining some sections that are indistinguishable from others that it held invalid, and saying that the law is okay because it's so narrow, being limited to the very core of political speech. Well, it had an odd genesis, too. There is something about this subject that precludes straight talk and honest analysis. And that, as far as I'm concerned, is a very good reason why it should not be regulated. The framers of the Constitution knew that political speech and activity needs the most freedom from legal regulation. When legislators, members of the executive, and sad to say judges come to it, they are afflicted by a self-interest that disables the dispassionate analysis so essential to adjudication. But if you want to see a dispassionate analysis, take a look at the briefs Solicitor General Bork signed in that case. I've gone on for too long, but I can't close without one final observation about Bob's post-Solicitor General years. You remember that he was mocked for saying during his 1987 hearings that he wanted to be on the Supreme Court because that would be an intellectual feast. That sounded like ivory tower hauteur. But you probably don't remember the rest of his answer. The book sets it out, and I quote, "I would like to leave a reputation as a judge who understood constitutional governance and contributed his bit to maintaining it in the ways I have described to this committee. Our constitutional structure is the most important thing this nation has, and I would like to maintain it and be remembered for that." Close quote. The book then wraps up in a fitting valedictory, and I quote again, "At the end of Nixon's presidency, without a soldier in the streets, we managed a transfer of power that would have shattered many nations. And yet, without a pre-existing love for the intellectual feast of law, I'm not sure that I would have had the wherewithal to make the correct decision that October night. Whether in a role as judge or as advocate, my two answers to the Senate Judiciary Committee are flip sides of the same coin. A life in the law requires a sense of both inquiry and duty. Without inquiry, duty slips into idolatry. Without duty, inquiry descends into navel-gazing." Close quote. Just so. Bob Bork did his country proud. We will miss him. Professor Calabresi, it's yours.
Thank you. Judge Robert H. Bork was, like St. Thomas More, a man for all seasons. His brilliance, wit, charm, and sense of humor helped him to revolutionize both constitutional law and antitrust law. Judge Bork was the first, and for a time the only academic, to challenge the judicial activism of the Warren and Berger courts. 2 years before the decision in Roe v. Wade, Judge Bork wrote a seminal Law Review article entitled Neutral Principles and Some First Amendment Problems, which laid the intellectual groundwork for the later emergence of originalism. Judge Bork's criticisms of judicial activism were withering and effective. He transformed constitutional law and helped to infuse it with a greater respect for the rule of law. Judge Bork was the rare academic whose work caught on, was read, and had a huge impact on the real world. This is because he wrote and spoke so eloquently, elegantly, wittily, and from the heart. Judge Bork was a man of action as well as a man of ideas. He was thus a kind of Platonic philosopher king, a label he would have vigorously resisted. Judge Bork was both an intellectual and a statesman, and he served with great distinction as Solicitor General under Presidents Nixon and Ford, as Judge Easterbrook has explained. As Solicitor General, Judge Bork played a key role in persuading the Supreme Court to reinstitute the death penalty in Gregg against Georgia, a case where he filed a brief that was also signed by Judge Easterbrook when he was working in the Solicitor General's office. As Judge Easterbrook has mentioned, Judge Bork became acting Attorney General of the United States in 1973 after the Saturday Night Massacre, a defining moment in the unfolding of the Watergate scandal. It was Judge Bork's integrity that helped to hold the Justice Department together in that early period. Judge Easterbrook has recounted for you the role that Judge Bork played in forcing Vice President Spiro Agnew to resign from office. And I strongly urge you to buy and read Judge Bork's memoir about his service as Solicitor General, Saving Justice, Watergate, the Saturday Night Massacre, and Other Adventures of a Solicitor General. It is a very entertaining and fun book to read. It's vital advice for anybody who wants to pursue a career as a lawyer, especially in government. And it's great fun and impossible to put down once one has begun reading it. Negotiating the resignation of Vice President Agnew, who pled nolo contendere to the charge of having accepted bribes, was an essential event to the outcome of the Watergate scandal. Vice President Spiro Agnew was, at the time, President Richard Nixon's impeachment insurance. The only person Nixon's enemies hated more than Nixon himself was Agnew, and so long as Agnew was vice president, Nixon had protection against being removed. When Agnew was replaced with Gerald Ford, that protection disappeared. The Saturday Night Massacre occurred on October 20th, 1973, 10 days after the Agnew resignation. And as Judge Easterbrook has already explained, Judge Bork played a starring role in that chain of events. Judge Bork declined to resign when Attorney General Elliot Richardson and William Ruckelshaus resigned rather than firing Watergate Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox, solely because he thought it was important to maintain the integrity of the Justice Department and not to create a vacuum where the White House might appoint a legal hack from the White House staff to be the acting Attorney General. Bork became acting Attorney General after the Saturday Night Massacre. He fired Cox as Nixon asked him to, but he asked all of Cox's staff to stay on and finish their jobs, and Acting Attorney General Bork then hired Leon Jaworski, a former American Bar Association president, to complete the Watergate investigation after Cox's firing in a professional and nonpartisan way. As all of you know, Leon Jaworski's criminal investigation eventually led to an order from the Supreme Court that the tapes of President Nixon's conversations in the White House be released. Those tapes revealed that Nixon was guilty of the crime of obstruction of justice, and facing certain impeachment and removal from office, Richard Nixon became the first and only president ever to be forced to resign and then to accept a pardon. Judge Bork played an absolutely critical role in the complicated series of events that led to Gerald R. Ford becoming president after Richard Nixon. President Reagan appointed Judge Bork to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit at the beginning of his administration on February 9, 1982. Judge Bork was the leading and most famous of a number of law professors who President Reagan appointed to the federal appellate courts, including Antonin Scalia, Richard Posner, Ralph Winter, Judge Frank Easterbrook himself, J. Harvey Wilkinson, Stephen Williams, Douglas Ginsburg, and Pasco Bowman. Judge Bork stood out among all these legal giants, and he was widely rumored to be a leading candidate for an appointment to the Supreme Court. Ironically, when Judge Bork first met Nixon the morning after the Saturday night massacre, the first words out of Nixon's mouth were something to the effect of, you will get the next seat that comes up on the Supreme Court. Bork explains wittily in his memoir that he did not have the heart to tell Nixon that after the Saturday night massacre, neither he nor anyone else who Nixon might nominate would ever be confirmed. Judge Bork was considered for a Supreme Court appointment when President Ford appointed Justice Stevens, but he was passed over, perhaps because of his role in the Watergate scandals. Judge Bork was considered again for appointment to the Supreme Court when President Reagan filled his first Supreme Court vacancy in 1981, but this time he was passed over for Sandra Day O'Connor because Reagan had vowed as a candidate to name a woman as his first Supreme Court pick. From 1981 to 1986, Judge Bork seemed like the apparent front-runner for the next Supreme Court nomination, but he was passed over again when Warren Burger retired so that William Rehnquist and a younger Justice Antonin Scalia could be appointed instead. During this period of time, Judge Bork served on the D.C. Circuit with great distinction, writing many eloquent opinions. He wrote an important opinion in Dronenberg against Eck, which was joined by Justice Scalia, and which rejected the whole Griswold v. Connecticut line of Supreme Court right to privacy cases. On July 1, 1987, President Reagan did finally nominate Judge Bork to the U.S. Supreme Court to replace retiring swing justice Lewis Powell. The political landscape had shifted sharply and precariously from the preceding summer. President Reagan was enmeshed in the Iran-Contra scandal, and the Republican Party had lost its majority control over the U.S. Senate in the 1986 midterm elections. Judge Bork's nomination to be the swing justice on the Supreme Court in this politically charged climate triggered a massive nationwide campaign by his supporters and opponents unlike any the nation had ever previously seen. The ferocity and viciousness of the campaign against Bork was stunning and more like a presidential campaign than it was like any prior Supreme Court confirmation process. Senator Edward Kennedy's disgraceful behavior in this process caused Judge Bork's name to become a verb. To Bork someone means to engage in a vicious exercise in character assassination. Throughout it all, Judge Bork maintained his grace, his wit, his eloquence, and his composure, and he became a hero to millions of Americans who watched the hearings on television and were horrified to see the modern-day equivalent of the killing of St. Thomas More be the original Man for All Seasons. After leaving the bench, Judge Bork became a prolific author. He wrote a total of 6 books prior to writing Saving Justice. His first book, The Antitrust Paradox, revolutionized antitrust law. He wrote a book on originalism and constitutional law, The Tempting of America, which was an important statement about originalism, and then wrote 4 additional books in his retirement, Slouching Towards Gomorrah, Coercing Virtue, A Country I Do Not Recognize, and A Time to Speak. He left behind a vast legal legacy and a committed movement of followers. Even in his retirement, Judge Bork continued to have an enormous impact on politics. This became evident when Judge Bork condemned the nomination of Harriet Myers to the Supreme Court, thus paving the way for the appointment instead of a brilliant conservative intellectual, Samuel Alito. Judge Bork's loud opposition to President George W. Bush's nomination of Harriet Myers was of a piece with Judge Bork's role in speaking truth to power during the Watergate scandal. Robert Bork was brave and effective, as well as being wise and witty. Judge Bork converted to Catholicism in 2003, and this seems like a fitting point on which to end because of the extraordinary degree to which Judge Bork's life was a living out of what St. Thomas Aquinas called the 7 virtues: wisdom, bravery, restraint, justice, faith, hope, and love. Judge Bork exhibited great practical wisdom throughout his life, as anyone who reads Saving Justice or The Tempting of America will quickly realize. He was an intellectual who transformed antitrust law and constitutional law, but he was also a savvy wielder of political power during the 1973 Watergate crisis, during his Supreme Court confirmation fight, and when he got Sam Alito instead of Harriet Myers appointed to the Supreme Court. Judge Bork had no patience for armchair philosophizing or speculation, and he also had no patience with the career-climbing politicians who he repeatedly knocked heads with in Washington, D.C. To say that Judge Bork was brave is a great understatement. Saving Justice repeatedly illustrates Judge Bork's bravery during the Watergate scandal, and the whole nation saw his bravery on display during the confirmation fight over his nomination to the Supreme Court. A third classical virtue is temperance, or restraint, and Judge Bork epitomized restraint during his career as a lawyer. He thought lawyers and attorneys general and presidents and Supreme Court justices should all follow the law, not make it. And it was his public advocacy of judicial restraint which led his enemies to try to burn him at the stake. Judge Bork's enemies knew that he could not be seduced by money or power or applause from his duty to follow the law, and it was for this that they especially hated him. The final classical virtue is justice, and if ever there was a just man, it was Robert Bork. Judge Bork fought like a tiger for the rule of law during Watergate, as Saving Justice reveals, and in his confirmation ordeal. Judge Bork would not agree to let Spiro Agnew or Richard Nixon off the hook if they were guilty of crimes just because they were powerful and well-connected. Nor would Judge Bork let Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun off the hook for his poorly reasoned and morally atrocious opinion in Roe v. Wade. It did not matter to Judge Bork that Justice Blackmun was a powerful man, or that he had even more powerful friends in the Senate and in legal academia. Robert Bork cared about doing justice, and he knew that required him to criticize Roe v. Wade. The final 3 virtues are faith, hope, and love, and are indispensable supplements to the 4 classical virtues. Judge Bork had a rock-hard moral character of the kind that is often associated with faith throughout his life, and this faith eventually led him in 2003 to convert to Catholicism. Judge Bork was throughout his life a believer in the idea that there is such a thing as right and wrong, and he held to that idea in the face of all temptations and obstacles with a tenacity that none can surpass. Judge Bork was also full of hope, because notwithstanding all the setbacks he suffered, and notwithstanding his own occasionally wry prophecies of doom, he never gave up hoping that the rightness and force of his ideas could help them prevail. I'm sure that if I'd ever told Judge Bork that he was full of hope, he would have denied it, but I'm equally sure that it was true. Finally, Judge Bork was full of love, expressed with kindness and consideration for everyone around him. He was a wonderful teacher because of the love he had for learning and for his students. He was a wonderful judge to clerk for because of his devotion and the affection with which he took up the role of mentor. And he was a wonderful and loving friend in his retirement. Many leftists did not understand in 1987 why Judge Bork was loved so passionately by his supporters, nor did they appreciate that that love would still be evident even after 25 years. The answer is not only that Judge Bork was a kind, witty, fun, and entertaining person to be with, who you could always count on to help you in a crunch. Judge Bork was all of those things, but there was something more as well. Judge Bork loved the law and the United States of America and lawyers, and the lawyers he knew too much to do the things the intelligentsia wanted him to do by backing down and criticizing the Supreme Court. Judge Bork will be sorely missed by all of us who believe in liberty, the rule of law, and constitutional government. We must carry on his mission with the same love, hope, faith, wit, dignity, intellect, character, and devotion to principle, which he exuded throughout his life. Thank you, and I now return this to Dean Reuter to take questions.
Thank you, gentlemen. If you've joined us late, we're, of course, talking with Professor Stephen Calabresi and Chief Judge Frank Easterbrook about Judge Robert Bork, his life and legacy, and, of course, his final work, Saving Justice, the book that a link to which is available on our website and was included in the notice you received for this call. With that, let's open up the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, you push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either or both of our experts today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open. We've got our first caller question. Let's go to our first caller question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Since both of you knew Judge Bork, perhaps you could explain or expand on what he meant by his famous remark about the Ninth Amendment being an inkblot. Was he mainly characterizing the way other people approached the Ninth Amendment, or was he genuinely confused concerning what its meaning might be?
Well, I'll be happy to talk about that. He was referring to his own view, and it's a perfectly straightforward one, which is that if you look at the Ninth Amendment, it doesn't have any affirmative content. It's a negative proviso. It says it's a rule of construction. It says that you can't use anything else in the Constitution to disparage the rights retained by the people. But it doesn't tell you what those rights are. It just tells you how to construe the rest of the Constitution. Now, for somebody like Robert Bork, you don't find concrete, positive rules of law in something that proclaims itself to be a rule of construction for something else. Bork very much believed that the Supreme Court was right in Marbury against Madison, when judicial review is derived from the structure of the Constitution as law. The critical step in Marbury to the great Chief Justice Marshall was finding some concrete legal principle in the Constitution. When all you've got is something that's open-ended, not concrete, vague, or in the case of the Ninth Amendment, just a rule of construction, you don't have anything on which the judicial branch can make a claim to displace the judgments of the elected officials. That's what Bob Bork was getting at, and he was absolutely right.
I'd just like to add to that that Judge Bork's first major article on constitutional law dealing with some First Amendment various problems, his Indiana Law Journal article emphasized that the Supreme Court and federal courts not only needed to announce neutral principles in their opinions, rules of law that would govern in future cases, he also critically argued that the neutral principles themselves must be derived from the text of the Constitution and the history that gave the text life. Judge Bork argued that it was unacceptable for judges to make up the law or to make up principles or rules that were not provided for in the text of the Constitution. And as Judge Easterbrook explained, the text of the Ninth Amendment is a rule of construction. It's not a charter to judges to invent rights or to come up with rights on their own. And I think Judge Bork's emphasis on the centrality of deriving rights neutrally from text and history, rather than as well as laying down neutral principles that would govern future cases, is a critical part of originalism and of the revival of constitutionalism to the extent there has been a revival in recent time.
So you don't think that he would have at least listened to the argument that what the Ninth was referring to was all of the rights that were lumped together from among those that were proposed by the state ratifying conventions? After all, there was a huge list of them from almost every state proposed a list. And although Madison chose to lump them together, one could certainly disaggregate them from that list.
I recently did some historical research on the origin of the Bill of Rights, and there's a very good study by Professor Donald Lutz on this subject. It appears as if the rights in the federal Bill of Rights mostly come from the state declarations of rights that were adopted between 1776 and the drafting of the federal bill in 1789. James Madison deliberately did not follow many of the recommendations of the state ratifying conventions. State ratifying conventions wanted things inserted that would have limited congressional power, such as requiring a supermajority to make rules about commerce or banning Congress from passing bills that would create monopolies. Madison didn't want to limit congressional power, so instead he wrote a Bill of Rights for the federal government that draws mainly from the state bills of rights, and which is actually somewhat less comprehensive than the state bills of rights. And I think the Ninth Amendment is, as Judge Easterbrook argued, simply a rule of construction and not a reference to things that were in other state bills of rights at the time the federal bill was adopted.
We have one more question pending at this point, and then our lines will be open. If you'd like to join the conversation, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to our next caller, let me inform you about next week's scheduled Teleform conference calls. We have four of them on our calendar at this point. On Monday, we'll be talking about the use of science in rulemaking. That's Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. Tuesday at 2 p.m., we'll be talking about public ownership of stock in law firms. Wednesday, there'll be a discussion with Judge Rader on intellectual property, and I apologize, that's on Thursday at 2 p.m., the discussion with Judge Rader on intellectual property. And then on Friday, we'll host a teleforum on the Pentagon, NSA, and cybersecurity. That's Friday at noon. And as always, the schedule is available on the Federalist Society's website. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is David Ingram with Reuters. Good afternoon. My question is that after Judge Bork's passing, there was some commentary from Akil Amar and others arguing that Judge Bork's legacy from a scholarly standpoint was much more about antitrust law than constitutional law. Could the speakers address address that part of Judge Bork's work?
Oh, I'd be happy to address the antitrust part of his work. And Professor Amar was right that his main scholarly interest was antitrust law. That's where he began in the academy. He had, was an antitrust specialist in private practice before he went to the academy. I mean, much of his work while he was teaching, much of his scholarly work while he was teaching was antitrust. As Professor Calabresi pointed out, he did write a famous article about neutral principles, but as a scholar, that was his main contribution to constitutional law. His book, The Antitrust Paradox and what preceded it, was the culmination of a long process of study and writing in antitrust, and really the culmination of what people often refer to as the Chicago School of Antitrust. Judge Bork had gone to the University of Chicago. He had spent some time at the University of Chicago before going into private practice and then to Yale. And he had spent a lot of time, I think it's fair to say, learning how microeconomic analysis, you know, classical and neoclassical analysis of markets worked, and then seeing how this could be applied to antitrust. The reason this is called the Chicago School is because much of the work was reflected in a journal, the Journal of Law and Economics, that was published at the University of Chicago. But you can be a Chicago School practitioner anywhere. And Bob Bork's book, The Antitrust Paradox, summed this up. And it was ironic in a way that this book was published in 1977, which was the very year that the Supreme Court handed down a series of decisions essentially adopting the Chicago approach to antitrust, starting with Chief Justice Berger's opinion in Reiter against Sonatone, saying that the antitrust laws are designed to protect the welfare of consumers, not of producers, and including the famous opinions in Brunswick, Fortner 2, and GTE Sylvania, which had overruled a decision 10 years ago that had protected producers at the expense of consumers. That quartet of four antitrust decisions fundamentally changed antitrust law, and we are still now where we were in 1977 and 78. The Supreme Court has never retreated. The neoclassical understanding of the way markets work is pretty much embedded in the law of antitrust, and Bob Bork gets a huge part of the credit for that. There are a lot of other people who participated, including my colleague Richard Posner, Aaron Director, Ronald Coase, who won a Nobel Prize in economics for some of the work he had done in this respect. I've even contributed a little myself, but certainly the leading book on this subject was published by Bob Bork, and he gets a huge amount of the credit.
I'd like to add a little bit to that. I agree with everything Judge Easterbrook said about antitrust law. I think Judge Bork had a transformative impact on antitrust law. Judge Bork had done his legal training at the University of Chicago Law School, and that had helped to shape his views on law and economics, and he carried that approach with him, first into practice and then to Yale Law School when he began teaching there. I should also emphasize that Judge Easterbrook is one of the leading authorities himself on antitrust law, something which he's too modest to say directly, but which I can say about him. On constitutional law, to get to your question about Akhil Amar's comment, I guess I'd mention a couple of things. First of all, I disagree with Akhil. I think Judge Bork is, in fact, probably the person who's had the biggest impact on constitutional debate over the last 40 years. There have been many other very important players, including Judge Easterbrook, Justice Scalia, former Attorney General Ed Meese, Justice Clarence Thomas. But Judge Bork was there at the very beginning. The article I mentioned, Neutral Principles and Some First Amendment Problems, was published in 1971, 2 years before Roe versus Wade, and it basically lays out the notion, the idea that the Supreme Court cannot derive principles of law from anything other than the text of the Constitution and the history that gave rise to it. The justices, it's not permissible for justices to derive rules of law from their own view of what is or is not good public policy. And Judge Bork said that 2 years before the decision in Roe versus Wade. He then, of course, criticized Roe versus Wade throughout his life because in Roe versus Wade, the judges, the Supreme Court justices, did exactly what he said they shouldn't do, which was derive a principle of law from their own policy views. Judge Bork, in The Tempting of America, a book which he published in 1990 after the confirmation fight, sets out his ideas about originalism in substantially more detail, and those ideas are very thoroughly developed and I think have had a major impact on the thinking about originalism of Justices Scalia and Thomas, among others, and certainly on many scholars. Ironically, I have to say that one of the scholars who I think Judge Bork had a huge impact on is actually Akhil Amar himself. Akhil and I had the great privilege of being students in the very last seminar that Judge Bork taught at Yale Law School before he left the law school completely. And it was a seminar on theories of judicial review. In that seminar, Professor Amar, then a third-year law student, as I was as well, in that seminar, Professor Amar argued vehemently for the position that language has no meaning and is infinitely elastic and can't constrain judges. And Judge Bork argued cheerfully, wittily, and with great force to the opposite effect. Subsequently, Professor Amar became an academic, and as an academic, he's been very much influenced by textualism. He makes many textualist arguments, and in fact, I think he rather thoroughly was persuaded by the critique that Judge Bork made in the seminar of the position that language was essentially meaningless. So I think it's always difficult to figure out who is a prime source of any set of ideas, but I think the notion that the text of the Constitution is of central importance, that the original meaning of that text is of central importance, and that whatever else happens, judges should avoid a policymaking role, I think Judge Bork argued for that from 1971 up until when he died, and he also tried to make sure that there would be qualified judges and law professors and lawyers who would reflect that viewpoint. So I respect Professor Amar greatly and consider him a great friend, but I completely disagree with him on Judge Bork's legacy to constitutional law.
We have two questions pending at this point in a little over 10 minutes. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, Stan Lankook in the Washington, D.C. area. In a conversation with Judge Bork, we talked about New York Times versus Sullivan. I have a political science background, and I've always had some problems with it. He said he felt the decision should have been contained to the immediate circumstances, which I believe was the University of Georgia athletic director or something, and not broadly written. I just wonder what the two participants feel about Judge Bork's remarks in New York Times versus Sullivan.
Who wants to respond to that?
Yeah, I'll say something briefly. I'm not acquainted with those remarks. And if that's what he said, I think that was uncharacteristic of him. The idea of judges writing for this day and train only, of confining closely to circumstances and so on, is not consistent with the idea that neutral principles derived from constitutional text and history inform decisions. The judge's job is to figure out what those principles are, and having done that, to use those principles to decide the case. When a judge says instead, the Alabama libel law has gone overboard here, actually dealt with the behavior of a sheriff, not an athletic director, but, state law has gone overboard here, we're going to stop it in this case, but we're not exactly sure why, and we're not exactly sure we can tell you what the principle is for which this decision stands. When judges say that, they're not doing their job. That's an example of judges making it up on political grounds rather than finding and deciding according to neutral principles founded in text and history. So my bottom line is, I'm surprised if Bob Bork said that, and I bet if he thought about it carefully, he wouldn't agree with it.
I'd like to completely agree with everything Judge Easterbrook just said. The essence of the rule of law requires that you state a general principle that you will be bound by in future cases, rather than deciding every case solely on its facts, like a cadi sitting under a tree adjudicating disputes. I had a chance to work with Judge Bork on a libel law case, Ullman against Evans and Novak, when he was on the D.C. Circuit, and I was clerking for him. And in that case, he read New York Times against Sullivan somewhat more broadly than did Justice Scalia. My impression was that he felt that particularly in the context where political speech was affected, that First Amendment freedoms were vitally important. The First Amendment applies to speech beyond political speech. It's not limited to political speech, and so it applies to art and to science, scientific inquiry, and other things as well. But particularly political speech is of central importance. And in New York Times against Sullivan, the issue essentially was whether Southern tort juries during the civil rights battles could greatly burden a national newspaper from the North, the New York Times, with an enormous judgment over a statement about the actions of a political official. And I thought Judge Bork was really quite sympathetic to New York Times against Sullivan based on my conversations with him when he was working on the Ullman against Evans and Novak case.
Okay, thank you.
We've got one more caller question at this point. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to the next caller.
Hi, this is Jeff Shapiro from McLean, Virginia. I'm in private practice. This is kind of an open-ended question. You talked about how Judge Bork had an influence on the law, particularly originalism and constitutional antitrust law. And, of course, he found the state of the rule of law as he saw it, and in probably not in good shape when he began. There was, dominance of left liberalism. I'll use that term very loosely. Do you have any sense looking back, whether, you know, where he sees the state of the law now, where we're headed, either from his recent writings, which I've not read, or from your conversations with him, does he feel we're moving in the right direction? Or was he despairing that, you know, progress has not been made? What was his sense of not just his own contribution, but the whole that movement, the impact?
I can say a little bit about that. I had the great privilege of being able to have lunch with him and with his wife, Mary Ellen Bork, 2.5 weeks before he passed away. And I think Judge Bork was very encouraged by the amount of interest in law schools, in originalism and in history and in constitutional text. And I think he thought that that there had been progress made in that context. Judge Bork tended to make witty prophecies of doom when talking about the Supreme Court or politics or judges. In fact, well, I think there is a very long way to go in terms of restoring a belief in the rule of law and constitutional government. I think compared to where the Supreme Court was in 1973 when it decided Roe versus Wade, significant progress has been made. And there's a need for a lot more progress, and it will be critically important who the next justices are who are appointed to the Supreme Court and what judges are appointed to the bench. But although Judge Bork might have said that he was pessimistic, I think, in fact, progress has been made, and I think he thought that there was progress that had made at least to some degree in academia.
Judge Easterbrook?
Bob Bork was personally and professionally pessimistic in a very witty way. When he was in the Solicitor General's office and somebody would make an argument in the line of economic analysis of law, he would be apt to sit back and say, ah, yes, another proposal for the cross-sterilization of ideas. And this, even though he was, you know, himself a practitioner of economic analysis of law. And many of his later books are filled with that kind of professional despair. But I agree with Professor Calabresi that he saw improvements in thinking about law. And let me give you just one example of the way in which people talk in the press, both lawyers and non-lawyers. Back in the 1970s, discussions, many of them initiated by President Nixon, talked about law in a way that assumed the only question is whether people carried out clear legal rules, right? And so we were going to follow a, quote, plain meaning approach to constitutions and statutes. Well, it turns out that in difficult cases, meaning isn't plain. And if all you have to offer intellectually is a plain meaning approach versus one that's heavily political, the heavily political approach is going to win because the plain meaning approach has almost nothing to offer. What Bob Bork offered, what many scholars have been offering, have been developing, a jurisprudence of originalism that is rooted in text but depends heavily on history and original usage. If somebody goes around and claims to you that the cruel and unusual punishments clause has a plain meaning, you should laugh. It doesn't have a plain meaning unless you understand its history, right? Much more sophisticated work needs to be done. And then when you're done with that process, it is the text in light of its history and in light of the interpretive community that was living in 1791 and how they used words that is governing today rather than the judge's druthers. But Bob Bork, in both his time in the academy and his time at the SG's office and his time on the bench, contributed, I think, a good deal toward the idea that there is, first, that there is a meaning that can be derived from more careful analysis and not from snappy, plain meaning analysis. And second, that when that meaning runs out, we adhere to the approach of Marbury against Madison, and the judges permit the elected officials and the living people to make their own decisions.
Well, gentlemen, I'm afraid we're going to have to let that be our final word for today. Of course, the Federal Society will revisit the life and legacy of Robert Bork in future programming. But let me thank both of you so much for joining us today. This has been a very interesting and a fascinating even discussion. I thank you both for your participation. I want to thank the audience as well for joining us today and for your participation. A reminder to join our next Teleforum conference call Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number when we'll be talking about the use of science in rulemaking. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.